funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How old is America's appetite for tabloid news? We can blame TV networks for serving up overhyped coverage of shocking crimes and scandals, but in fact, rumor-fueled fascination with sordid activities goes back at least to the days of the Founding Fathers. Two of them, in fact, would work in defense of a Manhattan carpenter accused of murdering a pretty young woman who seems to have had feelings for him in a much-covered trial that would dominate headlines just a few years before those same attorneys would battle one another to the death with dueling pistols. Paul Collins is here to tell us all about it. He's assistant professor of English at Portland State University, and you also may know him as NPR's Weekend Edition literary detective. His new book is called Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. Paul, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's good to be here.
What a story this is. I guess it makes sense, as you do in the book, to start us off with a little background on what it was like to live in New York City at the turn of the 19th century.
Well, probably one of the, you know, one of the predominant things that would come up if you were living in New York is that you wouldn't live there all year if you could help it. That one of the big problems was they had fever season in the late summer and going into the fall. Basically, when it would start to have the cycle of raining and then heat afterwards, and they'd get this yellow fever coming through the city, and it drove a lot of people, anyone who could afford it at least, out of the city. And the city at that point was actually comparatively small. You're talking maybe 50,000 people, 60,000. A lot of it concentrated in what we would now think of as kind of the financial district, down around Wall Street, the very lower part of the peninsula. At that time, Greenwich Village was actually still a village. You had to go across some fields to get to it, and it was where a number of people would actually go for the summer because it didn't seem to be as badly affected by the fever.
And yeah, there were theories back then, but nobody was entirely certain of how and why these diseases were transmitted.
No, there were some things that seemed to help, but no one was really quite sure. They knew that Greenwich Village didn't seem to be as badly affected, and that it had better drainage. It has kind of sandy soil, and that seemed to maybe be somehow connected, but no one was quite sure. And what we now know, of course, is that the yellow fever was being spread by mosquitoes, so if you have an area with good drainage, you're not going to get a bunch of standing water, and therefore you're not going to get mosquitoes. At the time, there were all kinds of crazy theories and treatments going around, most of which did far more harm than good. But really, it was almost like the city would just, things would stop for a few months. So the strange thing to me about New York at that time was that it was really sort of two overwhelming facts. One was that everyone seemed to know each other because it was still a relatively small place, certainly among the kind of the power structure of the city, and that they had this overwhelming kind of pause that they'd have to go through every time there was fever season. And those two things really, to me, kind of set up the basis for the time that both the victim and the accused and all the people around them in this case were living in.
So we will discuss the details of the crime in just a couple of minutes, but what sort of lives were Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr living at the time that this all went down?
Well, it was kind of a strange combination of public and private for both of them. So Hamilton had already served in the Treasury. He was basically serving at that point in the Adams administration to serving as a major general, basically building up the military for what was seen as a real threat from France. There were a lot of concerns at that point that France might invade. And so Hamilton was very, very hawkish about this, a great proponent of building up the military. And so he was spending a lot of his time on that. The problem with that job, and also, ironically, even with his time working in the Treasury, was that he wasn't paid very much for it. And so he was also one of the city's top lawyers, and so that was how he really paid the bills. And at that time, a lot of the cases involved, he tended to work more with sort of commercial law, and a lot of the cases involved either disputes over property, especially loyalists that had had property seized after the revolution, and also disputes over insurance for ships getting lost at sea. And Burr was very much in the same situation. He had also been involved in both national and state politics, but to pay the bills, he was working as a lawyer as well. And they both were living much more high on the hog than they could afford. They were both, you know, either had built or were building very kind of respectable mansions that seemed to befit their public station, but neither of them could actually afford it. So they were having to scramble to take on a lot of legal work to pay for that.
So we'll find out in a few minutes why that was so important in this case. But it is funny, as we know, we'll sort of fast forward, we know that they did take on this murder case. And I'm sure any attorneys listening are having trouble fathoming a time when someone who specialized in like corporate and contract law also took a murder case.
Yeah. It wasn't their usual line of work. They had both done a little bit of work previously in dealing with criminal cases of that kind. But really, it seems like in those cases, it was either very early in their career when they just needed some work or as personal favors. It really wasn't in their line at all. And they had actually, I should say Byrne in particular, had had some experience as a prosecutor. So he'd been on the other side of it and had certainly prosecuted criminal cases. But even so, it was not at all their usual line of work. They did have a third person that they worked with occasionally, though, and combinations of these three turn up in lots of different commercial cases, which was Brockholst Livingston, who's not nearly as well-known today as either of them, but was quite a major figure at the time in New York politics and in legal circles. And he actually did a lot of the same kind of commercial law as they did, but he actually was much more willing to take on cases involving violent crime. So he really, of the team that kind of wound up working on this case, he was the one that probably brought in the most direct experience with that kind of work.
What was Livingston's relationship, and he would, of course, go on to become a Supreme Court justice, but what was his relationship to these two men, Hamilton and Burr, that you describe as the best of enemies?
Yeah, he had known both of them from way back, either as a fellow aide to Washington during the Revolution or as a classmate. So they both had a lot of history behind them, decades of history between the three of them at that point. But Livingston was very much a part of the Republican Party and part of Burr's efforts to swing New York in the next election as well. So he worked most closely with Burr. But one of the strange things when you start looking through a lot of the cases at that time is it's not too often that you see Burr and Hamilton working together, although they did every once in a while. But you certainly see them on the opposite side of a lot of these commercial cases. And Livingston is liable to turn up on either side. So he had quite a bit of experience working with both of them in kind of one capacity or another.
Okay, so let's talk about this particular case that brought them together. There's this young Quaker woman named Elma Sands. What was she doing living in a Manhattan boarding house?
So, yeah, she was in at 208 Greenwich Street, which is this boarding house that where Elma was living. A number of her relatives were living there, including basically the landlords of the boarding house. And they had all come down from upstate New York. Initially, the landlord, Elias Ring, had really just been trying to seek out better opportunities. He had kind of a mechanical turn of mind, was quite inventive, actually. And so he sought out work as a mechanic, as an inventor, and he was kind of hawking these different inventions. And that hadn't really worked out, so he took up running a boarding house eventually along with his wife. And Elma had basically come along with them. She had been living with them for years. And so part of the idea was that she was going to stay at the boarding house with them. They also had some business ventures off to the side, hat making, things like that. in practice, Elmo was never able to pitch in that much on them as their niece, because she tended to be kind of sickly. She had a number of health problems, and so sometimes she would help them out, but she had to spend a lot of time just kind of waiting out her illnesses.
It's always interesting, you know, when you hear about people to wonder what exactly was the problem, and if they lived in a time of modern medicine, if they would be perfectly healthy.
Yeah, that is one of those things where it's often difficult to figure out from the language of the time. And it, I think in her case, from the descriptions, and you know, I am no doctor, but you know, certainly anemia was very common at the time, and the kind of descriptions that you get of her health, it could have been something as simple as that. But at the time, their understanding of things like anemia and iron deficiency was pretty limited, and so I suspect that in a great many of those cases, these are people that would have been you know, operating and kind of functioning in a perfectly regular way in modern society, but it was just a lot harder to figure out what was going on back then.
So who else lived at the boarding house, the Rings boarding house at the time, and what kinds of dealings did Elma Sands have with them?
So at any given time, there were generally maybe four, five, six other boarders in the house. But the more constant ones included Levi Weeks, who was a carpenter who had actually then become foreman at his brother's construction firm. His brother, Ezra, was really one of the most successful contractors and sort of developers in the city. And Levi Weeks was his younger brother. He was just getting started out, so he was still single, living at this boarding house and, you know, starting to make a name for himself within his brother's business. And then there were a few other people. Levi actually had his own apprentice who he roomed with. And there was a fellow there named Richard Croucher, who was English. He had just moved over from London, and he was a cloth merchant. He was kind of a door-to-door salesman, basically. And there were a couple other, kind of a rotating cast of a few other people. There was a shipwright who worked down at the docks who lived at this boarding house. There was a summonser, a guy who delivered legal summons, who lived in the boarding house. And there was another kind of distant relative, Margaret Clark, who lived there. So, you know, at any given time, there would be maybe about a half dozen other people, give or take, fewer during the fever season. A bunch of them would clear out during then.
So do we know anything about the relationship between Levi Weeks and Elma Sands? Anything definitive?
Well, we do know that they certainly cared for each other. And in particular, we know that Levi Weeks paid a lot of attention to her during her illnesses. A lot of the time, Elma Sands wasn't able to go work in the family business, and she would just be basically staying in her room. And so he would check in on her, usually in the morning before he was about to go to work sites and that sort of thing, and then in the evening when he came back in. And he was almost, you know, kind of more protective of her than maybe some of the other boarders. He would actually say, well, you won't take good care of her. Let me check. So, you know, he was very sort of solicitous of her health. A few times they actually went out. They made trips to the museum with one of the other boarders and that kind of thing. But a lot of the time when he would ask for her to go out, she would just say, no, I don't feel well. I'm too ill.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Paul Collins. You know him as the literary detective on NPR's Weekend Edition. He's also professor of English at Portland State University, assistant professor, and author of the new book, Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Paul Collins. He's assistant professor of English at Portland State University and acts as literary detective for NPR's Weekend Edition. His new book is called Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, so we have this potentially budding romance between Elma Sands and Levi Weeks, and then something terrible happens at the very end of 1799.
Yeah, so on December 23rd of 1799, Levi had actually been spending a lot of that day working. Most of the city had not necessarily been working that day. They had been attending services and things like that because George Washington had just passed away. But he decided he had a lot of work to catch up on. He had doors to design for a work site that he was taking on. And so he'd spent a good part of his day doing that, and he left that evening to put in a few more hours. And about the same time, Elma Sands left the boarding house, and when Levi came back later, he asked the landlady, "Where is Elma?" And her response was essentially, "I thought she went with you." Hmm. And the next morning came, and she still hadn't come back, and the morning after, and the morning after, and people started wondering what had happened. And at the time, the first assumption that a lot of people made, well, the very first one, was that she had run off with someone, maybe with Levi. And then when he turned back up, the next assumption was, well, she had either run off with someone else to get married, or that she had gotten pregnant and was basically seeking out a doctor to end her pregnancy, or a midwife or someone like that. And as the time sort of stretched longer and longer, then the question became, had she died during a medical procedure, basically, either while giving birth or while trying to get an abortion? Mm. And so that was actually the initial assumption that a lot of people made. The second one was that maybe she had, maybe for kind of similar reasons, that she had committed suicide. And so they started dragging the docks nearby. The boarding house was just two blocks away from some docks, and so that was the first place they went. And they started dragging the docks, didn't find anything. So that was initially where things stood. Nobody could figure out what had happened to her.
So her body was found in a surprising location that made it clear that this was not likely to have been a self-inflicted death.
Right. Where they did find her was the Manhattan Well. And so and this was just about the most controversial location politically that that sort of a scandal could turn up in. The Manhattan Well was in what was known as Lispinard's Meadow. And this was sort of part of that area that was basically between the city and then going up towards Greenwich Village. There were these sort of wild fields in between that, strangely enough, at the time were not very highly thought of. We're talking really about kind of modern-day Soho, basically. At the time, the area was sort of so wild and seemingly unusable that when someone had actually tried donating a bunch of it to one of the local churches, they turned him down and said, it's not even worth our spending money to fence this in. And this is, of course, now some of the most valuable real estate in the world. but they had what they had actually been using it for is they'd been sinking some wells in the area because as part of this effort to deal with yellow fever, a water company, the Manhattan Company, had been started in large part by Aaron Burr. And one of the wells they sunk, known as the Manhattan Well, turned out to not be a very usable well, but some of the locals still used it to get water. And it was when one of them had looked in the well, they found a scarf.
Hmm.
And then they also found a muff, which was kind of like an early form, really, of gloves, basically. It was just a way to keep your hands warm. And that was sort of the first hint that something was awry because it turned out to be one's belonging to her or that she had borrowed. So they went out there, looked in the well, and they found her in there. And some of the initial talk was, well, maybe this was a suicide, but the thing is, that's not how people generally committed suicide back then. If she had wanted to do that, she probably would have just walked a couple blocks to the docks or something like that. It became obvious pretty quickly that that this was almost certainly a murder case, and within days, it was all over newspapers and very soon up and down the seaboard, the Atlantic seaboard, that reports of this murder having occurred.
What made Levi Weeks the immediate suspect? I guess things were not so different then as they are now.
Well, that's actually a really good question, because initially he seemed to be the obvious suspect, because rumor had gone around that that they had been kind of a couple, and then the rumor went around that actually she had been going out with him that evening to get married. And I should add, back then, getting married, the actual marriage ceremony itself, was really kind of a formality. It was not a big deal. It was not a big ceremony. People would knock off work a couple hours early, go get married, have a nice dinner, and then that was kind of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of someone just suddenly taking off to get married was not so strange, especially, you know, if it turned out you'd been pregnant or something like that. And so there was a lot of talk circulating that she had gone out that evening to get married to Levi. So the suspicion immediately fell on him. And the fact that he protested that, no, they weren't an item and they weren't going out to get married, really only seemed to increase people's suspicion that he must have been the one that had done it. And so within hours, really, of her body being found, he was just almost presumed to be the person that had done it by most New Yorkers. He was arrested almost immediately, thrown in jail, and most people really figured that he was headed for the gallows.
Weeks, though, had the good fortune to be, you mentioned earlier that he worked for his brother. His brother was one of the most prominent real estate developers, essentially, in Manhattan at the time.
Yeah, he had already become fairly prominent, and he was on his way up. In his time, over the next couple decades, he really became one of the biggest developers in New York. And he was already pretty powerful at that point. And so, yeah, his brother Ezra, among other things, was about to build a mansion for Alexander Hamilton. He'd done some other work for him, and Hamilton was sort of planning out his dream house uptown, and was in the process of getting into a great deal of debt that he couldn't really pay. He just sort of figured that the property would appreciate enough that it would all somehow balance out.
It's a familiar story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so he was very quickly underwater. Mm-hmm. And this from the former Secretary of the Treasury. he really had a difficult time with his finances. Aaron Burr was also someone that worked quite closely with Ezra as well. And among other things, Ezra had actually provided the wood and basically a lot of the piping for the water system that Burr's Manhattan Company, which was this new water company, had put in. So Ezra had actually helped build the Manhattan Well. He basically helped build the crime scene.
Hmm.
So Burr and Ezra Weeks were both already kind of mixed up in the case, whether they wanted to be or not. But that was very much Levi Weeks' good fortune, because now Burr and particularly Hamilton both owed Ezra Weeks a lot of favors. And that was especially true of Hamilton, because back then, if you were in debt, if the debt came due and you couldn't pay, you could just be thrown in jail. You could be thrown into jail for debt. And that affected potentially anyone. The previous year, New York's Attorney General had actually been thrown into jail for debt. So being a prominent public figure didn't necessarily protect you. So when Ezra Weeks came to Hamilton and said, "I need your help," Hamilton was very ready to pitch in.
So, I mean, do we know at all whether they hesitated even privately about taking this on, having to work together?
There's no indication that they actually hesitated about working with each other. We do know from letters that Hamilton in particular held a very low opinion of Burr morally. They don't really seem to have had any doubts about each other's legal ability. And in fact, oddly enough, they were working on a commercial case together at about the same time. But Hamilton was very much of the opinion that, that Burr was an opportunist, and unprincipled, and he worried that given the opportunity, Burr would become a sort of a dictator politically if he gained enough power. And so they didn't trust each other a whole lot that way. But in terms of their respect for each other's legal abilities, I think it was pretty clear that they both knew that the other was very talented and that they could actually make a very good team.
I was fascinated to learn this, that it wasn't like the police department would dispatch detectives to check out the crime scene in 1800. That investigative work actually fell to the prosecutor?
Yeah, the whole legal system, and particularly the sort of the investigation phase, was really quite different at the time. And one of the odd things is that for most crimes, you actually had to go and get the police and have them go and arrest the person. They were not proactive at all. You had to find one of the constables around City Hall and say, look, I need you to arrest this person, and then maybe they would do it. But beyond that, they didn't actually do anything in the way of questioning. They didn't secure the crime scene. None of the things that we kind of take for granted as what police might do during that process was being done at the time, in part because they really didn't have police as we now know them. They had constables and they had night watchmen, and their job was, you know, primarily protecting merchants. As far as getting mixed up in sort of the petty crimes of the city, they would arrest people, but that was kind of it. As far as any investigation went, that was mostly left to the prosecutor. So it was a pretty busy job because they were pretty much on their own as far as gathering that information.
So how did, I don't even know if I'm saying this right, Cadwallader Colden approach the task?
Yeah, Cadwallader Colden.
Yeah. So how, he was relatively thorough.
He was. He was actually, so he was quite ambitious himself. He would later become mayor of New York City, but he was quite young. His brother-in-law had become the DA, so he became assistant DA thanks to a sort of a patronage system. And he had actually just blown a pretty major case, which was there had been a murder a few months previous by a guy named John Pestano. And Pestano was a recent Portuguese immigrant who had started hearing voices telling him that his landlady and landlord were out to get him, and he murdered his landlady and stabbed some of his fellow boarders. And so he was brought to trial and was found guilty almost immediately. And the problem with that trial, which Colden had been in charge of, was that he never should have been charged because he was quite obviously insane. And at that time, they had a very harsh legal system. You know, the sentence that Pestano got was death and dissection, which was pretty much the standard for a capital crime like that. And that sentence tended to be carried out within a matter of weeks.
Did the death at least come first?
Yes. One would hope. That came first, and then they would be delivered to a medical college and be dissected. And there was not a whole lot of hope if you got one of those sentences. However, his attorney in that case was Brockholst Livingston, who wound up being the third part of the defense team along with Hamilton and Burr. And Livingston, curiously enough, didn't try to defend him from the murder charge at all. He just didn't even try. His entire defense was based on bringing in people talking about how clearly unbalanced Pestano was, which was a very strange thing because insanity defenses almost never worked. They hadn't worked in a murder case in generations in New York. But he correctly figured out that Cadwallader Colden, as the prosecutor, had completely overstepped the bounds, that this was someone so clearly insane that the case never should have been brought against him. He should have been institutionalized, or actually what they would often do back then is they would just deport them. they'd say, well, we'll let you free, but you got to go back home. And basically, they would just let some other country deal with them. And they didn't do that. They sentenced him to death, and the legislature actually overturned it. And the governor signed off on it, which was a real, almost unprecedented slap in the face to the prosecutor. So Colden had really had his reputation damaged by this, and then this case came along, and it was basically his big chance to kind of redeem himself. And so he threw himself into it. He brought on scores and scores of witnesses, and it became what had already been a big case and widely reported. Became even bigger because Colden kind of quietly had his own career riding on it.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily that he had it out for Levi Weeks, but he just had to win this case.
Right, or mm-hmm. so he thought. Yeah, he was very highly motivated on the case. I don't know that he knew Levi particularly before the case or was necessarily even any more shocked by the case than any number of other murder cases he'd had to deal with. But in terms of his own career, he absolutely felt that this was something that he had to bring a lot of extra effort to bear and that he had to make it a slam dunk. In the Pestano case, he'd brought in something like four witnesses. And for Levi Weeks, there was more on the order of 60 or 70 waiting at the courthouse.
Hmm. My guest is Paul Collins. He's assistant professor of English at Portland State University, and he is the literary detective for NPR's Weekend Edition. His new book is called Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Paul Collins of Portland State University. You may also know him as the literary detective who appears regularly on NPR's Weekend Edition. His new book is called Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So as you mentioned, Colden had, dozens of witnesses in this case. How much time elapsed between the discovery of the body, the decision to prosecute, and the start of the trial itself?
So, yeah, the decision to prosecute came very quickly after the coroner looked at the body. But the trial was... It was just a couple months later, it was 2.5 months after the coroner had made his pronouncement, which would be very fast these days. At the time, that was actually a reasonably long amount of time to pass between the crime and the trial. So it was something where clearly Colden had the need for extra time just to get his evidence together. And the trial itself wound up lasting two entire days, and then it was verging really into a third. They got to the point where it was getting to about 2 a.m. And that was unheard of. Most murder trials finished up in a matter of a few hours. And they were actually so unprepared for the length of the trial that on the first day, they started getting well past midnight, and realized that the prosecution hadn't even gotten close to finishing making their case, let alone the defense. And they hadn't made any provision for this. They actually had nowhere to take the jurors. And so the jurors wound up, they wound up sleeping in City Hall.
It sounds awful. I mean, was it hard to find an unbiased jury given all the attention this case was getting?
Kind of. You know, the strange thing about the jury was that jury selection at that time was it was a very limited group of people. For one thing, women couldn't be on a jury. Mm-hmm. Freed slaves, let alone slaves, obviously couldn't be on juries. And then even among the sort of the white male population of the city, most of them actually couldn't be on the jury either because they had a property requirement that you basically had to have at least $250, which was a pretty decent chunk of money at that time. So it really had the effect of creating a fairly small pool of people that could serve on these juries. And one of the odd side effects of that is that they were mostly merchants, and they tended to know each other. One of the strange things I found is I started looking into the jury. I started kind of tracking each of them down and what their history was. They were people that had served in local political offices together. Two of the jurors had actually run a grocery store together a couple years earlier. And so the jurors knew each other pretty well. And in fact, some of them knew Hamilton and Burr fairly well, too. And that was, to me, one of the strangest realizations about the case was that the prosecutor had actually worked for a while with Burr and had basically been mentored by Hamilton. The court clerk had. The prosecutor had also known both of them well. The judge, the mayor had connections with them. The jury had connections with a number of the people in the courtroom. So it was, you know, by any modern standard, it was sort of riddled with conflicts of interest. But the way New York was at that time and the way that jury selection, the kind of limitations they had on it, that was probably inevitable. You had a small enough pool that, of course, they would have known each other.
And nobody had any issues with the fact that one of the defense attorneys owned the property on which the body was discovered?
You know, the strange thing is that was never brought up directly. Colden, if he had wanted to, could have actually called on Burr to testify, which would have been a very strange moment. But he didn't do that, and that was probably wise because Burr probably could have run circles around him, so it was just as well that he didn't. But yeah, had he wanted to, he couldn't have called on Burr to testify about his legal work with the defendant, but he could have had him testify at great length about the well itself.
So one of the reasons that you can write this book and know so much about the specifics of this case is that it was recorded in vastly greater detail than a lot of contemporary criminal cases.
Yeah, that to me was the moment when I realized that was wonderful for me as a historian, because it turned out that this case, it excited so much interest at the time that before the trial had even started, there were ads running in newspapers saying that the court clerk was actually going to record the entire trial and that this was going to be published, which was a very unusual step at that time. To the extent that newspapers, for instance, would cover trials, they would give you a summary. You'd be lucky if you got a direct quote at all anywhere in the article, and the articles would be fairly short. Occasionally, a case might generate a pamphlet or something like that. That would come out afterwards, but they tended to be fairly short, very little in the way of direct quotation. And now papers were running this promise that the court clerk himself was actually going to publish something about the case before it had even gone to trial, that there were already ads running for this. The big surprise of the case was that right after the trial ended, within hours, there was a printer that was beginning to circulate copies of an account of the trial. So the first thing that happened was that the court clerk had a march stolen out from under him by a competitor. And he got very angry about this. A guy named William Coleman, who was the clerk, got really bent out of shape about this. And while he was busy getting bent out of shape and venting in the local newspapers, another person published another account. And One thing that was interesting about this to me was that Coleman not only resented the fact that he had competition, he kind of denied the idea that they should even be allowed to do this. And their accounts were very perfunctory, but these competitors pointed out, you know, quite rightly, that the trial didn't belong to him, that it belonged to the public, and anyone who wanted to could write an account of the trial. And so I think that was kind of an important moment that was pressed home in that aftermath, that anyone could comment on this, anyone could circulate their own account of the trial. But what wound up coming out of it was that Coleman, he realized at that point that all the impulse buys had already been taken up because he'd now had two competitors beat him to the punch. And so he spent weeks coming up with something much, much better, which was a complete account of the trial. And so it was just a stenographic account, basically, that from start to finish, that had all the witnesses in it, and not only included the answers, which some of the other accounts had done in the past, he also included the questions, which it's strange to think now, but that was kind of a new thing. A lot of these pamphlets, when they came out after trials, if they included direct quotes at all, they would just quote the witnesses. They wouldn't necessarily quote, they wouldn't actually quote the prosecutor or the defense team. And what he was giving was a full-on account from beginning to end with basically with all the dialogue. And so it was kind of a literary landmark in a way, and you could actually really understand how the trial works much better because of that. But also for me, as a writer, it was wonderful because now I actually had the full argument, the full back and forth that was going on in that courtroom.
What did you discover about the legal stylings of Hamilton and Burr and Livingston?
Well, Livingston is a bit of an enigma. He spoke very little during the trial, but that said, I suspect he had an important behind-the-scenes role because he was certainly the most experienced of the three of them in terms of dealing with murder cases and with criminal cases in general. But within the trial itself, Hamilton was the lead counsel, so he was really kind of running the show. That makes sense, I think, for a couple of reasons, one of which is that he was the one that was also the most directly in debt to Ezra Weeks, so he had the biggest favor to repay. But also, I think he was really the better speaker of the two. Hamilton has legally kind of a reputation for really knowing how to work a jury. He could be very stirring and you know, really could really speak to jurors quite directly. And Burr was also a very effective lawyer, but he was better known for strategy. And I think a simple way to put it would almost be that when Hamilton spoke, he spoke to the jury. When Burr spoke, he was speaking to the judge. Burr was much better at catching out people, essentially on procedural matters, on technicalities. And in that sense, he was much wilier than Hamilton, and one of his old law partners mentioned how Burr loved setting up ambushes, basically, in the courtroom. He really enjoyed just letting people walk into something and then springing it on them, which is exactly what happened in this trial. The prosecution set up this very elaborate case against the witness, but it was elaborate in the sense that it was over the top and had lots of witnesses, but it didn't entirely hang together. And that gave Hamilton and Burr a real opening.
I'm not going to reveal the sort of, you feel like you have evidence of who committed this murder, and we'll leave that, to people who read the book. But I suppose it's a matter of public record that things went well for Levi Weeks.
Yeah. And that was something that probably nobody but his defense team expected going into the trial. People just assumed that he was going to go to the scaffold. And one of the interesting things was that Hamilton and Burr argued the case so effectively that when the verdict was given by the jury, the courtroom cheered, which was the exact opposite of what anyone would have guessed going in.
Yeah, because people had been out for blood in terms of they wanted Weeks to hang.
Yeah, and were yelling at him that they wanted him to hang as he walked into the courthouse. So he had a very hostile crowd arrayed against him. And I think it speaks to his defense team's skill that they completely turned it around. And that at the time, there was really no question that what would have been a really tragic injustice had been averted. The curious thing is that Hamilton and Burr both had their own suspicions, and very strong suspicions, about who they thought had actually done it. And I will say this much, it was one of the other boarders that they suspected, and who they also suspected of spreading rumors about Weeks in the first place that had made him a suspect. And some of what happened subsequently seemed to bear out their suspicions, but one of the things that I came across was actually looking through old legal records, not only around the U.S., but then in Britain, to see if there had been basically a previous record for any of the other boarders in the boarding house. And without giving away too much, I'll say one of them, that paid off spectacularly well. There was a very long and troubling history behind one of the other boarders, and a dangerous one for that matter.
It makes it hard, frankly, to suspect anybody else once you have read that portion of the book.
Yeah, it does. And it's one of those things where I think, short of a signed confession turning up in the rafters of someone's attic, I don't know that the case will ever be absolutely settled, but it certainly... I think it may be as settled as it's going to get.
So we all know what became of Burr and Hamilton in subsequent years, but what kind of life did Levi Weeks have after his acquittal?
You know, strangely enough, his historical reputation, I think rather unfairly, has been that he's someone who maybe got away with murder and just got off because he had a really good defense team. And that's the second part of that is certainly true. I think in the hands of a less capable lawyer, he would have been executed. Strangely enough, even though a lot of people were quite surprised by the verdict at the time, there really wasn't that much public sort of enmity being voiced against him afterwards. Most people seemed to understand the verdict. Even so, he had just had his name dragged through the mud.
Yeah.
And had been accused of murder. And he spent a couple of years in New York trying to sort of stick it out and gave up. Initially, he moved back in with his parents in Massachusetts. That didn't go well.
Just have a few seconds left here.
Yeah. When he tried moving back in with his parents, there's actually a great letter from his father where he's basically complaining more or less about his citified ways, that he's come back from New York and
can't go back.
Yeah.
The new book by Paul Collins is called Duel with the Devil, the true story of how Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr teamed up to take on America's first sensational murder mystery. Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts with production assistance from Lindsay Connect and a podcast produced by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.